Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thank you for listening to this podcast of Real Recovery. There are many more podcasts available at myfaithradio.com. Your support makes this possible. Thank you.
Help, I need somebody. Help, not just anybody. Help, you know I need someone.
Hello and welcome to what I promise will be another award-winning episode of Real Recovery. Awful glad you joined us tonight. Bill Arnold on this side of the studio and just across the way, only separated by chicken wire, George Fraser. Hello, George.
Billy, how are you?
Good. I'm thankful to be behind the microphone today with you. The nice thing is, behind microphones, we will never be mistaken for leading men. Isn't that nice?
It is.
It takes a lot of pressure off.
Well, you know, I think one of the great things about being on radio is we're free to travel about without being harassed by people for selfies.
That's so true.
You know.
They say that familiarity breeds contempt, which is why I'm always suspicious when somebody says, I'd like to get to know you better.
I like that. I like that.
We have a great show tonight. Lila is going to be with us in just a few minutes. But, George, as you know, we always love talking a step. And tonight we're going to talk about step 10. You being the step expert, I would like you to go ahead and tell us what that is again.
I don't really think I'm the expert on anything, but step 10 is we continue to take our personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. Now, there's a couple things here. When we do our inventory in step 4, it's a moral inventory, and we're going to look at our resentments, our fears, our sex conduct. But in this inventory, I want to do it every day or maybe more than one time a day and also look at the good things that God has done in mm-hmm. my life. Not totally a negative deal. Are you sober? That's a gift from God. Are you saved? That's a gift from God. What are all the blessings that have come from your recovery? Because we look at John 10:10, I came to give you life and give it to you abundantly. Are you experiencing that? And if you are, being grateful, Bill, it's really hard to be negative or be, you know, somewhat down when you realize all the things you have. And that's part of this step. The other thing is, as our good friend Dr. Glenn Pickering said, just because you're wrong doesn't mean you're bad. Mm. Give yourself permission to be wrong. And I think one of the freeing things about being in recovery and being saved for me is I can look at it and go, gosh, I was really wrong there. Let me see if I can make that right.
Well, George, when we look at step 10 and you try to review your actions, what, every day?
I find I can do it very well at night.
Okay. So are you patient with this yourself in this process?
I'm not patient with anybody.
Yeah, okay.
I think because I can bounce it off my mentor, Denny, I've learned to be less judgmental of myself and more factual. And what I mean by that is, okay, how are we doing? Am I measuring up to who I want to be? Am I doing what I say I'm going to do? Can people count on me to show up? And when I mess up, do I confess my sins to God and get forgiven and repent? I think one of the things we see with guys we work with, and I know in my own life, it's real easy to go, yeah, real sorry about that, but I really don't feel that bad about it,
mm-hmm.
bad enough to not do it anymore. And I think so I want to hold myself accountable and be honest that way.
Yeah. Well, most of us would like to just be healed from any addiction, healed permanently with no need to have any ongoing continuation of anything.
I need to be healed from me. You know, and I
agree.
Thanks for the affirmation.
Yeah,
you know?
Well, you were looking for it.
Any
I gave
attention
it to you.
I get, I thrive on. But I think that's the problem. And when we get into recovery, if we're honest about it, and you really have to be if you're going to stay in recovery and get sober, you have to have that rigorous honesty, which for a lot of us is the only time we've ever done that. Am I really growing as a person? Because if I'm not growing closer to God, I'm going farther away from him. And eventually I'm going to wind up using again. But am I doing what God created me to do?
Mm-hmm. Proverbs 14:29, George says, a patient man has great understanding, but a quick-tempered man displays folly.
Get to it.
Yeah, I just did.
Yeah, and that's folly. And I think one, for me, and I think for a lot of us in recovery, impatience is very hard because I want what I want. I want it right now, and I want a lot of it.
Mm-hmm.
And let's pick up the pace.
Right. Now, when you had that infamous family meeting when you were in recovery.
Which one? Which time at treatment and which family?
Well,
you know, you got to narrow it down
here,
Arnold.
I'm sorry. I shouldn't paint with such broad brushstrokes. But there, your dad was there, and so he had the legal pad out.
He was always there.
Okay. All right. Now, I'm trying to connect some dots here. You're making me work.
Sorry.
In James chapter 1, verse 23 and 24, it says, anyone who listens to the word but does not do what it says is like a man who looks at his face in a mirror and after looking at himself goes away and immediately forgets what he looks like. Now, your dad would say to you, George, if you were really sorry, you would stop doing what you're doing.
Yeah, well, of course, my dad added to it because he was Bob.
Right.
A real man.
Ooh, ouch.
You know? A real man. Like, yeah. I'm a phony man. I'm a fake man. A real man, if he's truly sorry, he doesn't do it anymore. And it's like, man, I had no comeback for that. And that was a moment of mental clarity when I realized how desperately wicked and in trouble I was.
Yeah. But the promptness in admitting our wrongs is key to step 10, isn't it?
Well,
just to be able to respond quickly.
Yeah, the recovery book talks about we're not saints, but we're willing to grow along spiritual lines. And they don't mean that you're not saved. It's that you're not perfect.
Mm-hmm.
But I judge the quality of my recovery by a couple things. A good barometer is the quality of my relationships, which today are pretty good, and how quickly I get out of the relapse process and back to recovery. What do I mean by that? The relapse is a process by which we return to chemical use. Important for a couple reasons. I can identify it and change it. If I know my relapse warning signs, I can do it. And one of mine is intolerance, impatience.
Mm-hmm.
If I get out of line, I realize it and go back quickly. And that's the measure of my recovery now versus 5-10 years ago. I would stay in that bad, angry mood, resentful, angry at people. And I can't love a God that I don't see when I'm not loving a brother that I do see.
Okay. I'm just trying to put
some... Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. I'm trying to put some of these dots together here. No, it says promptness in admitting our wrongs is important. So if I say to you, boy, George, you're rude and insensitive. Oh, I'm sorry I
said
that.
Thank you.
I'm sorry I said that.
Okay.
Well, if I'm promptly admitting I was wrong for saying that, why did I say it in the first place?
Well, we have to, I think, I have to give up what I get out of doing it. I like saying stuff like that to you.
I know.
And so do you.
Of course I do.
You know, sorry, God forgive me for that. But I'm not really sorry about it because I keep doing it. The rigorous honesty is my whole being is sinful. And I was listening to your afternoon show the other day.
The highly popular one.
It's, you know, I noticed I drove by the studio.
Mm-hmm.
There were people standing outside with signs. I think they were happy about the show. It was so crowded here.
Yeah.
And
they were in favor of it, right?
Yes.
Oh, good. What a
relief. So I put my sign away and drove off, but no, and the guy was, you guys were talking about how sinful we really are.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that gets minimized, especially by people that go, hey, I quit drinking. I'm good now. If you're really walking the walk, the more you get to know Christ, the more sinful you realize you are,
mm-hmm.
but the more loved, you know, he gives you.
So, George, if we are taking inventory on a daily basis, is that going to help us avoid a major relapse? Or is that no indicator?
Well, absolutely. If I keep doing what I'm supposed to do, what I truly want to do, and walk with the Lord, I should be okay. And if the growth is there, you'll see some things like, okay, you and I are... with each other because we're such good friends. We give each other some sarcasm and hard time, and we enjoy that. It's intimacy by insult. But if I'm okay with hurting somebody's feelings, even if I didn't mean it, that's not growth. And I got to a point in my life where I thought, you know what? I'm not okay with insulting people, but also the growth is not only are you not doing what you shouldn't do, but are you doing everything you could do? And if you really get walking and growing as a recovery person in the Lord, Bill, you're going to look at opportunities, not just of what you committed, but what did you omit?
Hmm.
What could you have done that you didn't do? And that's real growth for a lot of us.
Mm-hmm. No, of course, we're all fallible humans, George, and we're all going to make mistakes. So that's going to be the part we're going to have to deal with as well.
And well, if you're in the game, yeah.
Yeah, but what about using that as a constant excuse? Hey, sorry, I'm just human.
Works for me. No, I...
But is that, can you just say that? Is that your stock response?
Well, it...
And does that satisfy?
It was for a long time. I don't think you can have good relationships when you do that. I think what we need to do is, there is some truth there, and in every lie I know, there is partial truth, and that's one of the tools of Satan. But what I need to do is, I am fully human, and part of that is, if I want to be Christ-like and holy and forgiven, I have to admit when I'm wrong to Christ and pray for the power, strength, the desire to change it and work on that.
Mm-hmm. All right, George, patience may not be our favorite virtue, but it's pretty important in the healing process, isn't it?
What is our favorite virtue?
I realized I painted myself into a big corner there.
Yeah, we could come back. That's a hawk.
Yeah, let's try that. We'll take a short break. When we come back, we're going to bring on our guest, Lila. We'll take a short break and be right back. Welcome back to Real Recovery. Bill, George, awfully glad you're with us tonight. We had a fantastic conversation a couple weeks ago, George, if you remember, with Jim S. Remember that conversation?
He was great.
Not only was he great and interesting and vulnerable and open and
funny,
but he also let us know that he's got a wife that is all that and then some.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so we're excited to talk to her as she's with us tonight on the program. Her name is Lila. Hello, Lila.
Hello.
Did you listen to your husband, his interview with us?
No, I haven't yet. He listened yesterday.
Oh, good.
And I didn't have time, but I'll tell you, just after hearing you guys this morning, I can't wait to listen to you guys from now on. And George, if you were a woman, I would want you as my sponsor. I just learned so much in what you had to say. It's amazing.
I've never had anybody say that if I was a woman, so I got to chew on that for a while. I mean, I got the Lululemon on. Maybe I need to get some Carhartts. No, thank you. I love the fact that you're available to talk about your walk and your recovery, because for me, and I know for Bill, this is as good as it gets for us. So thank you for being available. And I guess what I'm always interested in is, kind of quickly, but what was your family like growing up? And can you take it to the first chemical use you had?
Yeah. My family are all, well, I come from a functioning alcoholic family. And nobody admitted they were alcoholic until I did. I'm the youngest of five kids. My mother was killed in an accident in Mexico when I was 12. And my father was a doctor. And so everybody to this day are functioning alcoholics. There's tons of doctors in my family, lawyers. And so, you know, it's sort of like you don't want that known out there. My first use was in high school. I remember being, passing out. There were so many signs at the beginning that I was alcoholic, but nobody saw it as that. It was just, she's young, whatever, you know, everybody test this out. But, I remember passing out, I passed out at a dance, and my date took me to a car and just put me in a car, and he went back to the dance. The car happened to be some friends of ours, which I don't think he knew at the time, but they took off, went to an apartment, drugged me in the apartment, and I passed out there. And one of my girlfriend's fathers the next morning was looking for his daughter in this apartment and knocked on the door. I didn't know where I was because I'd been passed out all night. He came in and he said, you know, what's your name? I told him my name. He said, is your father, you know, the doctor, da-da-da. I said, yes. He said, well, I'll see him at the hospital in a few minutes because this guy was a doctor, and I'll tell him exactly where you are. So that was one of my first experiences. My father grounded me, and I remember him saying, you're going to be raped someday if you continue with this. And I thought he was crazy, and as I get on with my story, I'll tell you that did happen to me. But there were signs right on, right away, that I was an alcoholic.
So were you raised with God? Were you raised Catholic? Or?
I was not Catholic. I was raised in a congregational church, and my
was
father...
Too.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, we talked about everything but Jesus.
Yeah, yes, exactly. And actually, once I got in the program, I kept going to the minister and saying, you've got to get this relationship with God. You know, I don't see it here, you know.
Yeah.
But you come to a meeting with me just to see how people have a relationship. And I was so, he didn't want anything to do with it. But anyway, I was raised congregational. My father basically did not have God in his life, but he used to, after my mother was killed, he used to take us to church, drop us off, and then he would go to the hospital and make rounds, come back and pick us up. So, but when he was on his deathbed, literally, I said, do you believe in God yet? And he said, I sure hope there's one. So whatever that's, you know. He taught me a lot about God by the man he was. I mean, he was a good man.
Well, he was, you know, obviously very successful, and he gave up a good part of his life to help other people.
Yes.
You know, I always admire doctors for doing that. I've seen quite a few myself the last couple of years. I wanted to get back to if there was a base there, and it sounds like you knew who God was, but probably didn't call on him till you needed him.
Right, and it never actually occurred to me that you could even call on him. Because of my upbringing in this congregational church, it was like you just didn't have a relationship. So I learned that in AA, and it took me a long time, you know, because I really didn't know who he was. And I was brought up in a family where you rely on yourself, pull yourself up, and so not knowing who God was, to be able to turn my life over to him was like impossible. I didn't get it at all. And also, because my mother was killed when I was 12, I just, you know, I had to pretty much bring myself up, even though my grandmother lived with us and we hired a cleaning lady or a housekeeper, maid, whatever. And then my grandma's chauffeur lived with us. And so that, and all the older, there were five of us, but only two of us at home at the time. The rest were in college. So that became my family. And there was no God in that circle of friends. You know, you had to bring yourself up. So I was so reliant on myself that to give that up and to rely on God took a few years in AA for me to watch how it was done, and then to see, well, it, you know, God's working in these other people's lives. I guess he'll work in mine.
So
my first experience doing that was my husband had chosen a sponsor, and I did not like this guy. I thought he was a street guy, you know, kind of a bum. And it was like, how could this guy help us? And I was so codependent at the time. Notice I say help us. It didn't have anything to do with me. It was Jim's journey. But at that time, I was so codependent. I thought he was going to bring us both down to his level. It just sounds horrible to say. But anyway, I remember my counselor at the time saying, you need to turn this over to God. And the idea of that was just, I said, well, no, I can't do that because this is a real problem. You know, that's all I'm doing, talk like that. And she said, no, turn it over to God. So this was my prayer at the time. It was like, okay, God, I don't know who you are, but I'm going to turn this over to you and only this part. And if you do okay, I'll give you some more. And we'll just see how you do with this problem.
So you start with the training wheels. Put the training wheels on God to see how he does.
Yeah. So I had to wait 1 year. And, of course, you know, I want things. I want it now. I wanted to find out that day if it was going to work or not. But nothing happens on my timetable, which is a huge lesson I learned in this. And after a year, that guy was exactly who my husband needed. Exactly. He was a fundamentalist in AA. He gave my husband everything he needed, a solid foundation that still works for him today. So that was an eye-opener for me that there really is a God, and I could rely on him.
You know, that is so true, and it's very interesting. I want to go back, if we can, that first drinking experience. You wake up, and unfortunately, you know, if I'm a kid in high school who drank, which I was, one of your parents, friends shows up when you wake up all hungover in another place. That's really bad break. But what happened next?
Well, he did go to the hospital, and he told my father, and my father grounded me, and I thought it was the worst thing on earth. He took my car away from me, my phone, all those things. And so I was grounded for a month, and it really, you know, I was so angry during that month. But after the month was up, I thought, this is exactly what I needed. You know, you're attracted to the same level of dysfunction as you are. And I was attracted to all the wild, crazy kids in high school.
Mm-hmm.
I thought they were the popular kids. And to be away from them for 1 month was a good break for me. And it gave me a chance to look at what I was doing. And even though I didn't change that behavior outwardly, inwardly, I gained some knowledge during that month. Like, I need to be attracted to different kinds of people. And actually, when I went to college, I thought, I'm going to start all over and try to attract different kinds of people.
Where did you go to college?
I went to Gulf Park Women's College. It was in Gulfport, Mississippi.
Okay.
And in the 60s, Mississippi, that was another story, too. But they offered water skiing and sailing for courses, so I wanted to go there. And they had synchronized swimming, so I was into it. My father made me go to a girls' school because he thought I missed out on something by not having a mother. And so I had my choice between all the girls' schools in the United States, and that's the one I chose. But what I found out was, you know, wherever you are, you know, wherever I move, there I am.
Yeah. So Lila, let me hit the pause button here just for a second, because we need to take a break. But when we come back, we're going to continue our conversation we're having with Lila. Thanks so much for listening to Real Recovery. We'll take a very short break and be right back. Welcome back to the show. In Matthew 16, it says, "For whoever wants to save their life will lose it, but whoever loses their life for me will find it." It's having a great conversation tonight with Lila. She's coming to us on our studio line all the way from Des Moines, Iowa. George,
is she in West Des Moines?
I don't know if she's in
West
Des Moines.
That's more prestigious, isn't it?
It is slightly more prestigious. Lila, where in Des Moines are you? I hope I'm saying that right.
I'm in West Des Moines.
See? That's the prestigious area.
Does Patrick live there?
Patrick does live there, our friend Patrick. Yes, indeed. So anyway, when we last left off with Lila, she was on her way to college to an all-women's school that had water skiing and sailing.
I love this.
I do, too.
Synchronized swimming as well.
Of course.
Did they have that back then?
I don't.
Sorry about that,
so,
Lila.
George.
You could take that the wrong way.
Yeah.
You don't want me to be your sponsor anymore, do you?
Yeah, you just lost it.
I lost it. Sorry.
So, Lila,
they have synchronized swimming. In fact, Des Moines has one of the oldest synchronized swimming clubs in the United States. But it wasn't in the Olympics until just recently, because I was chosen to be in the Olympics at one time, and we practiced for a whole year, and then they chose not to have it in the Olympics.
How How cool.
No kidding.
Who started that? Esther Williams?
No, but it was Esther Williams was just the movie star who looked like she knew what she was doing.
Okay.
But, there was a lady here by the name of Teresa Anderson who started the first club here in Des Moines.
That's really tough, Bill.
That is. That's really hard.
So I don't do it. I love lap swimming, though. But let's get back. So you go to college. You know, you kind of put the bottle away for a while, or you're trying to moderate it, right? And what happened?
Well, that didn't work. Like I said before, you're attracted to the same level of dysfunction. And so this school was so strict that you couldn't drink all the time. But when I did have the opportunity, I would drink and always come back drunk. And you have to sign in and out when you went to this school. So the house mother would always call me in the next morning. She would just say, look how you signed your name. And it would always be like 10 lines down from where I was supposed to sign in and scribbly. And, you know, at the time, I just thought it was really funny. But I never really got in trouble for it. So I just continued with that there at that school. And then I transferred to the University of Iowa my junior and senior year. And then I had all the freedom in the world, and it really took off then. And I remember I told you that my father said that first time I passed out that I'm going to be raped sometime. And my senior year, that is what happened. I had a date with one of the baseball players that was well-known on campus, and I got drunk, and he raped me. And it was just it was horrible.
I'm very sorry.
But, you know, I didn't. Yeah. And but that wasn't the end of that. That happened a few more times in my 20s. I remember being on a cruise ship one time. Someone broke in the room. But, you know, I was drunk. And always thinking I deserved that because I was drunk. And somewhere in all of that, you know, I just kept pushing that down like it didn't happen. In fact, I still do that today, just push it down or make fun of it or whatever instead of really dealing with it. But there were so many signs along the way that just said, you're an alcoholic, you need to stop. But it wasn't until I married my husband that I looked at him. And, well, we got together because I chose him because he was the wildest guy I knew. And we joke around saying we both drank the same thing. But watching him, I could all of a sudden see myself. My sisters used to tell me what I was like drunk, and I never believed him. But when I saw my husband drunk and I wasn't, it was like, ooh, this is what I look like. And he brought two kids to the marriage, and I thought, we have got to grow up here. And we were on a vacation in the Keys, and he got really mad. He was drunk. He stood on a table and called me these names that I don't think I should say on your show right now. And I remember saying, I'm out of here. This is the end. And I walked out and I thought, I'm leaving him. I'm done with this. I'm done with the drinking, done with the alcoholism, done with this behavior. And so I walked out and thinking, I'm leaving him. And then I realized we were on an island and I couldn't get off. And so I had to go back in. But what I did tell him was that when we lived in the state of Washington at the time, when we got back to Washington, I was going to get a divorce and that we were splitting up. Well, he had to go to New York for a meeting, and I took the kids back to Washington. And I remember calling a counselor who I didn't know. I opened up the phone book and just literally closed my eyes and pointed to one. Called this counselor, and I said, this is the deal. My husband yells and screams when he's drinking, and I've had it. And I want to leave him, but I think it'll look better in the divorce if we come to a counselor first. And this counselor, I didn't even know. This was on the phone. The counselor I didn't even know said, well, you need to stop drinking first, and then we can talk. And I remember thinking, I said to her, well, drinking's not the problem. It's him. He's the problem. And she said, no, I'm telling you, drinking is the problem. So when he came home, I told him that I had called this woman. And I said, I'm done drinking. I was done in Florida. That was January 1st, 1986. So I've been sober 32 years. And he said, my husband said he would quit too. Because I said, if you continue drinking, I'm done. I'm out of here. So I gave him that chance. So he just lied to me for 4 years. Drank when he went out of town on business. And then it caught up with him. He got an OWI and he had to tell me what was going on. So
yeah, but he wouldn't have got it if he had automatic headlights.
Yeah. That's the only he forgot to turn on the headlights. Yep.
What was that like for you? You're sober. You think your spouse is sober, and then you find out they're not.
It's like someone had pulled the rug out from under me. First of all, for those 3 or 4 years that he was lying to me, I thought he was having an affair. I knew something was wrong, but I just didn't know what it was, and he was lying. And I was mad. I wasn't seeing a counselor. I wasn't going to AA meetings, and I wasn't saying I was alcoholic. It was just I was a problem drinker, and I quit.
So you just quit for 3 years?
Uh-huh, 3 or 4 years. And then when Jim, but there was so much anger in me, it was like in my head, I'm going, you want to see how you do this? This is how you do it. So that kept me going. It was just showing him that one of us has to quit and this is how you do it. And there was no recovery in that at all. So underneath, I was just steaming all the time, mad, angry. That anger, that energy kept me going. But after he told me that he had been drinking, it was like the rug had been pulled out from under me. I don't like anybody lying to me, just one little lie. So this is a 3 or 4 year lie. And I, again, was so angry. So I just said, we're going to a counselor. So we went to a counselor every week. We made a deal. We went to several counselors, and if either one of us felt uncomfortable, like the counselor was liking one person more than the other, we chose not to go to that person. So we kind of shook on that, and that was a good deal because we tried out several. Ended up with one fantastic woman who knew exactly how to corral us in, get us into AA, and make us work a program. She was fantastic. And but we went every week for 3 years. And then I went alone for 3 years, and Jim went alone for 3 years. So we went to a minimum of 3 meetings a week. We still do after all these years. But I will say that we had a pretty good foundation under us after 3 years because we worked really hard at our relationship and ourselves.
Wow, Lila, that's a powerful testimony to patience and perseverance and a willingness to work really hard.
Yes.
That's so impressive.
But I will tell you, people come up to me today and they go, oh, I want what you have. I go, well, are you willing to do what I did?
That's
because
a great...
everyone wants what I have, but you know they want it right now.
Yeah, and they don't want to go through. They don't want to go through the work. Lila, let me take one more break, and then when we come back, we'll continue. You're listening to Real Recovery. Our guest Lila is coming to us tonight from prestigious West Des Moines. We'll take a short break and be right back.
And his head fell behind her as his arm had reached around. Oh, and she looked at the window. She watched the shade.
See, we were not gone long, and we're back listening to Real Recovery. Bill and George, we've got Lila on our studio line. thought it was interesting, George, when she said they went to counselors and their deal was if the counselor started liking one person more than the other, they would find a different counselor. That would never be the case with you, would it? No counselor would go, well, I like George better.
No, we'd still be looking.
Still be looking.
You know?
Yeah.
But what's interesting to me is God putting a willingness in both their hearts to keep the relationship going. So obviously they had a great love for each other and still do, but also a willingness to do the recovery thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because it didn't happen by accident. You know, they're going to like 3 recovery events a week plus counseling. And usually what happens when you go to counseling, you're going to find out things that you need to work on. And most people, when they find out they need to work on something, they're fine and good to go when they hear mm-hmm. that. And most of us in our recovery keep going and listening till there's something we're unwilling to do. And as we always tell our guys, Bill, that one thing you're unwilling to do is probably the game changer.
Right.
So, great story.
You've said that many times in recovery groups where you say, what is the one thing you're not willing to do or you haven't done yet, that's the thing that you probably need to do the most.
Well, we lose that gift of desperation when we're beaten into a state of reasonableness by our circumstances. And then we start feeling better and we become less and less willing to do whatever it takes. And I always want to be as willing to do in my 30-plus years today as what I was at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how you do it,
yeah.
I think.
So, George, you had a question for Lila?
Or, I did,
yeah,
but
you forgot.
You know, the big bong I had in high school is still a consequence. I wondered how. Sorry, Lila, not real maturity. It's real recovery. And the question I had is how you guys proceeded. You're going to all these recovery activities and counseling. How did you get to find Jesus?
We actually changed churches, and because I was in search of finding God, finding Jesus, and my church that I'd gone to for 50 years was not providing that for me, and I was trying to guide them there, and they didn't want it. So I was invited to this new church, and it was the second I sat down, it was like, this is where I need to be. And, in fact, it was kind of spooky because I was sitting there thinking, I was saying to myself, I don't know why I'm here. I have a church and I feel guilty that I'm here. And, all of a sudden the minister said, if you're here, I don't know, whatever he said, it was just like, he read my mind. And I can't believe this guy read my mind. And every week after that, I felt like he was reading, the pastor was reading my mind and saying something. And I was so spooked out by that, I went to his office and I said, something weird is happening. I'm thinking something and then you say it. And he said, do you know how many people come to my office? It's because you're open to God. And that energy is just flowing from God to him, to me. And it was just reassuring. It was like, okay, I'm on the right track here. But it was, once we moved to this new church, both my husband and I and our children just dug in deeply and took all the classes we could and just felt this inspiration to keep going. And it was, and I could develop this relationship. It was like they were backing my relationship that I was learning in AA. And in fact, this particular church hosts lots of AA meetings, and there are tons of recovery people in this church, and they welcome them.
It is interesting when the Holy Spirit is leading you and your heart is open, that everything you're starting to hear from God's Word starting to make sense and resonate, and you want more.
Yeah,
it's no surprise at all.
And I'll tell you, it has become the basis of my living now. And so when I'm a substance abuse counselor, and so when people come into the treatment center so broken, none of them have God in their life, and you have to meet them where they are, it's a challenge mm-hmm. for me, because none of them want God.
Right.
And most of them don't want sobriety either.
No. So I remember going to my pastor, and I said, do you think God's mad at me because I don't talk about him right away? I have to kind of sneak this in so that they aren't turned off. I use different language, I guess, until they feel comfortable with it. And he said, no, I think it was Peter or Paul, somebody in the Bible. I'm not real familiar with that, with the stories, but he said he did the same thing with people.
What's
so it's a challenge for me daily, because this, to me, this is the answer, is to have a relationship with my higher power, with God.
Yeah, it's interesting.
For everything.
Lila or George, the answer is Jesus, but what happens when you don't want the answer to be the answer?
It just takes time, you know. What I tell my people is just don't say no, just be open. Be open to new ideas and say, I'm not there yet, but I hope to be. So that you're open to new ideas, and little by little, it'll seep in.
Yeah, I agree with that. I grew up in a Congregationalist background, too. I did get saved before I got sober, because our minister in high school came to me one night. It's after, like, burning down our house, getting kicked out of high school, OD'ing a couple times, and said, George, if you died tonight, do you think you'd go to heaven or hell? And I said, well, I'd go to hell for sure. And he said, do you want to change that? Yeah. You know, and I got saved, but I didn't get sober till years later, and I really wasn't able to, you know, you're doing coke Saturday night, and then you go to church Sunday morning all hungover. That's like a purgatory thing, right? You know, you're dying there.
Yeah.
But when I started working the steps, God grew to me on a different level. And the 12 steps for me is how I walk out my faith. And we're talking about how people meet God. And I worked in secular treatment centers for, I don't know, 20 years, not 15. And then I went to a Christian place because God convicted me that my time there was done. I needed to, you know, talk more about Jesus, which you can't do. I get that. But I think God draws us all in. And the fact that you're there, you're going to be the only Jesus they see, and they see it by actions. You know, people don't change by what we say to them. They change by how we love them. And they come in all beat up, and the process goes, you're telling them what the truth is. They don't want the truth. They can't handle the truth. I stole that. But what happens is God draws them into where they're broken down enough that they're going to go, hey, the Holy Spirit hits you. There is a way out. God does love me. I got a person here who's loving me. Even though they know all the worst things about me, they want to help me get what they have. And that's what you're doing. And God had allowed your lives to come to this point, and I think God draws all of us, Bill. Mm. And, you know, we think, well, I did it. I didn't want to get sober. Are you kidding? I was like you. I was cool. I'm partying. But I don't know. God drew me, and it's like recovery so much better than using. And I had a lot of good times using. I know you did, and I know your husband did from talking to him. He sounds like a great guy. God draws us, Bill.
Yeah, George, I've seen pictures of you from the 70s. You weren't that cool. I mean, I've seen the
I was a lot cooler than you were.
Well, maybe.
I still am. I mean, you know, that's a God gift.
Yeah, but the clothes and the hair. Eh.
Yeah, the hair was bad.
Yeah, you were like Starsky and Hutch, but not in a good way with the outfits.
I will tell you, though, that watching somebody go through this transformation is so cool, just to see them not believe in anything to believing. Is really, really cool.
It's our greatest joy. It's my greatest joy when I see someone who's lost, who maybe had a lot of bad information growing up about God. You know, they just, they thought God hated them. And you start to teach them the truth about what God's word teaches, and they start to feel very different. And then reason comes into their brain, and the Holy Spirit leads them to a point of turning their life over to God. And then they become a new person. And to watch that happen, I never get tired of that.
No.
Yeah.
One of the things you said, Lila, that really is a joy to hear. We started going to the church, Bill, and we all started taking as many classes as we could and doing this, and they're all in on this deal because they like it. And that's what happens to people when God draws you in. You were created to do this, and now you finally are. It's just a great story, and you're giving it away at work.
Yeah. Not just at work. It's, if I'm not at work, I'm doing it. My husband and I, if you were to ask our children what their life was like growing up, it would be, my mom's on the phone talking to somebody with NAA, my dad's talking to somebody, or our kitchen table has strangers that they're trying to help, NAA, that need help. So that was their story always. And so it helped them later in life when at least my daughter needed help. She's been sober now 9 years, I think. But she knew exactly where to go when she needed help. And my son still doesn't need help, but he has directed so many people to AA or Al-Anon because of his experience growing up.
Mm-hmm. Lila, talk a little bit about your faith in action, how you are now spending a lot of time and energy helping people, even outside your work.
Well, I do just that. It's like I never give up on people. And I have one young lady now who everybody else has given up on. And I just, even though it takes a toll on me, I just won't give up on her because I always feel like she's on the verge of getting this. She used to be really close with God, and she was young and had an affair with a pastor, and they got married. And anyway, it just ruined her whole. Anyway, they're since divorced, but just kind of ruined her idea of God. And I'm trying to bring her back into the AA program as well as church. And, you know, there's a little opening there that I think that maybe she'll get it. But it's constant. It is my life. This is what I do. And it's one way of, you know, all the stuff that we did back when we were using, it's one way of turning all that bad stuff into something good. And I can use all those experiences to help people. And because I had so many experiences, different kinds of experiences, I can help all different kinds of people with their troubles or whatever.
Yeah, Bill, we will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door upon it. And we will see that no matter how far down the scale we have gone, our experience can help others. God allowed it for a reason, and he helps us get sober, Lila, I believe, because he has a job for us, not just to get us to stop a behavior.
Absolutely. And that's how I stay sober. It's, you know, helping other people. And any time, you know, we don't always see how we're helping other people. There are many times that people have really disappointed me when I've put in a ton of time and they go back out. But I figure that's part of the, you know, God's plan. Maybe I was only supposed to be a part of the answer. Mm-hmm. And that's usually truth, you know, that there are lots of people that need to intervene on this person, and I'm just one part of it.
Lila, you have been a sensational guest. Thank you so much for being on the show tonight.
Thank you.
Yeah,
thank you.
Yeah, Georgia, again, another award-winning episode of Real Recovery. That wraps up all the time we have for tonight. Have a great week, and I'll see you next week.
And everyone knows that you're my favorite girl, but there's some.
Thanks for listening. Programming like this is made available through your support. Information available at myfaithradio.com.